In honor of the Olympics, the Teaching Company is proud to present a pair of free commissioned lectures, Ancient Origins of the Olympic Games. The lecturer is Professor Jeremy McInerney, Davidson Kennedy Associate Professor in the Department of Classical Studies and Chair of the Graduate Group in Ancient History at the University of Pennsylvania. He received his Ph.D. from the University of California, Berkeley. One of our most popular instructors, Professor McInerney, teaches three of the great courses, Ancient Greek Civilization, The Age of Pericles, and Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic Age. Feel free to send the link to this lecture to any family or friends who also might enjoy it. It is free for them as well.
Hello and welcome to our two-lecture mini-series on the Olympics. It seems a good time to look at the original Olympics from the ancient world and to make a bit of a comparison between the ancient Olympics and their modern counterpart. So in the course of the next two lectures, I want to discuss how the ancient Olympics came about and how they were run and what the events were, and then to talk a little bit about the significance of the ancient Olympics from the point of view of the Greeks. And if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about the origins of the modern Olympic movement and the relationship between the two. You might find it interesting as we explore this because it transpires that, in fact, there's a great deal more difference between the ancient and modern Olympics than similarities. But let's go back to the origins of the Olympics. From about 776 BC onwards, the greatest champions among the Greeks began assembling every 4 years at Olympia in Western Greece, to assert their strength and their physical prowess. These men thought of themselves as the living embodiment of the Homeric code. But where Homer's heroes, men like Achilles and Ajax, displayed their prowess on the battlefield, the athletes of the 8th century BC used sport as the medium of their contests. These men would run, jump, wrestle, box, and drive chariots to demonstrate their arete, or valour, and to win kleos aphthiton, or undying glory. Their models were Homeric, and the Olympic Games were a manifestation of the degree to which Homeric values supplied the dominant ideology of early Greece. And really, whether we call it the Homeric Code, the aristocratic ideal, or the Olympic spirit, it boils down to the same thing: proving one's manhood in competition. So to understand the origins of the Olympics, we really need to begin with Homer. 500 years before the first Olympics, the Greeks had witnessed the growth and the decline of a powerful civilization we call Mycenaean. Excavations at places like Mycenae and Tiryns have unearthed the massive walls and the corbelled tombs fashioned by this warrior culture. When that civilization collapsed, its fortresses abandoned or occupied by squatters in the 11th century BC, Greek society suffered terrible dislocation. Central authority evaporated, many people took to the hills, and the complex network of trade connecting Greece to the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean for a time broke down. Ironically, this material and physical decline was compensated for by a brilliant poetic flowering. Travelling poets told the story of a golden age of heroes, the men who fought at Troy, who placed personal honour above all other considerations, and who looked on war as the truest test of manhood. It was a dream. It was a fantasy. It was no more real than the Hollywood version of Troy. In fact, the Homeric poems were the Hollywood of their day, shaping the dreams of men who, in the 9th and 8th century, wanted to be as brave as Achilles, as wily as Odysseus, as powerful as Agamemnon, or even as buff as Brad Pitt. But war, as Homer certainly understood, is fatally destructive. And what makes a man a truly great warrior, the capacity to kill, isn't necessarily a helpful social skill. And so, brilliantly, the Greeks found a way of celebrating physical strength and speed divorced from its military setting. The Olympics were, if you will, warfare displaced. The specific connection between Homeric poetry and the Olympics comes about in the habit of Homer's heroes of celebrating the death of a prince with funeral games. In the world of the Golden Age heroes, the death of a great man is celebrated by a competition in which his peers compete for prizes honoring their dead comrade by their performance. Here's a good example. In Book 23 of the Iliad, Achilles lays out prizes for the Greek heroes so that they will compete in the funeral games honoring their dead friend Patroclus. One of the events is wrestling, and here is Homer's account of the match between Ajax and Odysseus. Up stood mighty Ajax, son of Telamon, and wily Odysseus, full of cunning, rose also. The two girded themselves and went into the middle of the ring. They gripped each other in their strong hands like the rafters which some master builder frames for the roof of a high house to keep the wind out. Their backbones cracked as they tugged at one another with their mighty arms, and sweat rained down from them in torrents. Many a bloody bruise sprang up on their sides and shoulders, but they kept on striving with might and main for victory and to win the tripod. That match ended in a draw. Ajax and Odysseus then go and have a running race, which will also end badly when Ajax slips on a cowpat. Not very heroic. Another contest, a chariot race, ends up with an appeal to the judges, a touch that looks distinctly modern when you read it. We have to imagine, in other words, a world in the 8th century where chieftains and aristocrats were hearing these tales of might and competition in the poetry that they absolutely adored. But we also know that they were meeting in real places like Olympia and Delphi in order to perform in actual competitions that grew out of the myths that they heard about in the Homeric poems. There's another passage that helps us to understand the Olympic spirit in early Greece. In the course of his wanderings, the hero Odysseus is shipwrecked on the island of the Phaeacians. Being Odysseus, the master of cunning, he, of course, conceals his identity from his hosts. He doesn't want yet to let them know that he's one of the great princes who has fought at Troy. He doesn't want to reveal his heroic status. Until, at one point in the proceedings, he is challenged by some of the young Phaeacians. Laodamas looks at Odysseus and he says to his friends, "Come, let's ask the stranger whether he's skilled in any contests. His build is strong enough. Look at his thighs and his calves, his two arms, his stout neck. He's as strong as a bull. Clearly, the Homeric hero, like the Olympic athlete, is meant to look larger than life." And so they approach Odysseus, and one of them says, "Come, sir, and take part in our athletic competition if you have the skill, as, by the look of you, you do. For there is no greater glory for a man as long as he lives than that which he wins with his own hands and his feet. Come, make trial, and ease your heart's care." Now, Odysseus tries to avoid the challenge. He's been hearing stories about the Trojan War, and it's brought back to him all of the nightmares about his experience, and he's longing for home. So he really doesn't want to rise to the challenge. And he says, "Laodamas, why do you mock me with this challenge? Sorrow is in my mind far more than athletic contests. I've suffered much and toiled much, and now I sit in the midst of your assembly, longing for home and making my prayer to the king and to all the people." Well, this merely annoys the Phaeacian young bloods, and Euryalus, in his annoyance, says, "Well, yes, stranger, for I see that you have no experience with competition. You're probably the captain of some rickety merchant ship, someone who cares more about his freight and the trip home and the profit to be made. No, you are no athlete." And so, of course, Odysseus picks up a discus and he hurls it farther than anyone else, thus demonstrating his prowess. And that really is what the Olympic spirit is all about for the Greeks: performing beyond the level of an ordinary human, proving your excellence, which is demonstrated in competition, and winning glory, just like a Homeric hero. The Olympic hero, like the Homeric hero, was supposed to be larger than life. And you might want to consider the story of Milo of Croton in the 6th century as an illustration of what a truly gargantuan character the Olympic hero could be. This is a man who, as I said, in the 6th century, won 6 victories at Olympia in wrestling and 6 at the Pythian Games, which were held at Delphi. So that's a career that spans 24 years, since the Olympics were held then as now once every 4 years. This was a man who clearly had the staying power of someone like Cal Ripken. But he didn't just have staying power, he had bravado as well as brawn. To celebrate one victory, he killed a sacrificial heifer with one blow of his own fist. He then hauled the beast onto his shoulders and ran the length of the stadium with it. And then after that, he had the beast cooked for him on the altar and sat down in the middle of the stadium to eat the entire animal in the course of one day. Milo was a real character. Pausanias tells us more about him, including the fact that he even carried his own statue into the sanctuary in order to dedicate it to Zeus in commemoration of his victories. That would be a little bit like an athlete awarding himself the gold medal at an Olympic ceremony these days. And Pausanias continues with more stories about this wonderful character, Milo. He would grasp a pomegranate so firmly that nobody could wrest it from him by force, and yet he did not do it any damage with the pressure of his fist. He would stand upon a greased quoit, says Pausanias, and make fools of those who charged him and tried to push him off. He used to perform also the following exhibition feat. He would tie a cord around his forehead, as though it were a ribbon or a crown, and then, holding his breath and filling with blood the veins on his head, he would break the cord by the strength of these veins. That's quite a showstopper. So the next time you see a gold medal winner at the Olympics posing for the cameras like Mr. Olympia, be grateful. It could be a lot uglier if our modern athletes really wanted to identify with their ancient counterparts like Milo of Croton. The Olympians were supposed to train hard and to practice a regime of diet and exercise. Arriving at Olympia 1 month before the games were scheduled to start, they exercised daily in the various training facilities such as the gymnasium and the palaestra or the wrestling ground. If you go to Olympia today, you can still see versions of these buildings. Most of the athletic facilities that you see at Olympia now are from the Roman period when the sanctuary was very famous and very wealthy, but there were undoubtedly earlier versions of these same sorts of buildings and facilities going right back into the 5th and 6th and probably 7th centuries BC. So the athletes would meet there on a daily basis to do their training in these facilities that were very close to the Temple of Zeus, which lay at the heart of the sanctuary. One of my fondest memories of visiting Olympia involves just these training facilities rather than the great Temple of Zeus. I was there a couple of years ago sitting in the training grounds to the west of the sanctuary with a modern-day Olympian, a member of the US swim team from 1960. And as I listened to him, he reminisced about what it was like to be preparing for the swim that he was about to undertake. And in fact, he went on to win the gold medal. And as he was talking about getting into the zone, as athletes say these days, it was very easy to imagine the thousands of ancient athletes who congregated at this same place during the Olympiad for a month before the games, and then while the games were on, in preparation for their event. Athletes there stretching their muscles, being massaged with oil by their attendants, no doubt praying to the gods for their success, and doing this all under the watchful eye of the men who were called the Hellanodikai, a name that means literally the judges of the Greeks. And these men, the officials who were in charge of the running of the Olympic Games, were judges whose job it was to ensure that only Greeks participated and that the athletes who did participate were up to the standards of the games. In other words, that they qualified. And they were also there to make sure that nobody cheated. And unfortunately, we do know of instances from antiquity where various athletes were found to be cheating. A row of statues right in the middle of the sanctuary commemorated those who had been found guilty of cheating. And so their shame was immortalized just as truly as the fame of those who were victorious. The athletes trained and they competed naked, as was customary for the Greeks when it came to any aspect of their exercise. And this was a feature that the Greeks thought of as distinguishing them from the barbarians. Many vases depict athletes running, wrestling, and boxing, and the figures are always naked. But a little-known reference in Thucydides suggests that this wasn't always the case. The line in the chapter in Thucydides, says, "The Spartans were the first who, in their athletic exercises, stripped naked and rubbed themselves all over with oil." But this was not the ancient custom. Athletes formerly, says Thucydides, even when they were contending at Olympia, wore loincloths, a practice that lasted until quite lately and still prevails among barbarians, especially those of Asia, where the combatants at boxing and wrestling matches wear loincloths. So, if Thucydides is to be believed, it was the Spartans who were looking for that slight edge. Perhaps they thought that by wrestling naked, it would be harder for their opponents to grab hold of them. A little bit like athletes today, always looking for that little edge in their equipment. After their month at Olympia preparing for the games, the athletes were then led to a statue of Zeus that was housed inside the council chamber located on the southern side of the sanctuary just beyond the Temple of Zeus. This council chamber was the official meeting hall used by the Olympic officials, and in it there was a statue of Zeus. Now, this is not the very famous statue of Zeus that was made by Phidias, the great Athenian sculptor, the statue that stood inside the temple of Zeus, and which was regarded as one of the wonders of the ancient world. The statue that I'm talking about, the one inside the council chamber, was a statue that showed Zeus standing and holding a thunderbolt. And apparently, it was a very scary statue, and it was designed to scare the athletes. The reason for this was that it was a statue of Zeus Horkios, Zeus, the god of oaths. And Pausanias describes for us the ceremony that took place in the council chamber in front of this statue. Pausanias says, "Beside this image, it is the custom for athletes, their fathers and their brothers, as well as their trainers, to swear an oath upon slices of boar's flesh that in no way will they sin against the Olympic Games. The athletes take this further oath also, that for 10 successive months they have strictly followed the regulations for training. An oath is also taken by those who examine the boys, or the foals entering the horse races, that they will decide fairly and without taking bribes, and that they will keep secret what they learn about a candidate, whether he is accepted or not." So, they took this matter seriously, swearing an oath by the father of the gods that they had trained for 10 months beforehand, and of course they've been observed for 1 month before the games to make sure that they really are good enough to qualify. Well, the oaths have been sworn, the athletes have qualified, the judges have certified them. Let the games begin. And what games they were? Here's a list of the events that formed the core of the ancient Olympics. First came the stadion, a sprint race. Now, stadion is the word that refers to a distance of 600 feet, which is the distance of the race, but it's also the Greek name for the venue, for where the race was held. And we still use that word, although we give it its Latin pronunciation of stadium. So, when I use the term stadium, I'm referring to the place where it took, where the event occurred. But when I say stadion, I'm referring to the distance of 600 feet and the race of that distance. So, the stadion was a race that was a sprint down the full length of the stadium, a distance, as I said, of 600 feet or 192 metres. So we should think of that race as being quite comparable to our own 200 metre sprint, but done straight rather than on a curved track. Some ancient writers maintain that this was the original event of the Games, and that for the first few Olympiads in the course of the 8th century, this was the only event. There's really no way of checking this accurately. There's still debate about it today. We don't know for sure whether there were other events at the very beginning of the Olympics, but it is certainly true that many religious festivals in Greece that didn't have athletic games formally attached to them did include a run, often a torch race, that was held in honour of the god. So it makes sense to think of the sprint as being the original event. Next, after the 200 metre sprint, came an event called the diaulos, which was a sprint to the end of the stadium and back, a distance of 384 metres, so again, almost equivalent to our own modern 400 metre race, but as it was a sprint to the end and back and not around a circular track, the times would probably have been a little slower than they are today. The next event was the dolichos, which was a long-distance race. It comprised 12 laps of the stadium, or 24 times the length of the stadium, putting it closest in distance to the modern 5,000-metre race. There was also a pentathlon, and that term means, in fact, five contests. The penta meaning five, the athlon, the word from which we get athletic, meaning a competition. And so there were five events in this, and the ancient pentathlon consisted of the long jump, the 200-metre sprint, discus, javelin, and wrestling. Long jumpers began from a standing start, but they were permitted to hold heavy stone weights, which they thrust out in front so as to propel their bodies forward. We've got pictures of these on vases, so we know exactly what it looked like. The discus favoured balance as well as strength, just as does the modern sport, and again, statues that show ancient discus throwers make it clear that that event was very much like its modern counterpart in terms of the way that the discus was held and the athlete twisted his body before hurling the discus off. And the javelin also was like the modern incarnation, using a simple wooden javelin with a metal point. In addition to the pentathlon, there were competitions in boxing, in pankration, and in chariot races. Boxing was even more brutal than the modern version of the sport. Boxers wore leather strips that were called himantes, bound around their hands, but they had no protective headgear, and they fought until one man conceded defeat. There were no weight divisions, although there were age divisions. There was a separate competition for boys, probably up to about the age of 18, and then there was a men's division. But since there were no weight divisions, it was simply open to any man, the sport clearly favoured the biggest men, and the statues that we have of ancient boxers from antiquity, as well as the vases showing these boxers, reveal men who today would clearly fight as heavyweights. Massive muscles, flattened noses, cauliflower ears. In one famous statue that survives from the Hellenistic period, we see a boxer who appears to be sitting in the corner waiting to go out to fight, and his face is bruised and battered, and he looks already exhausted from the many fights that he seems to have fought over the course of his career. Pankration was another boxing-style event. It's sometimes called all-in fighting, and it was a modified form of boxing that did not use himantes, in other words, it was bare-knuckle fighting, and it also allowed kicking. In fact, it allowed everything except gouging and biting. So it probably looked a little bit like Thai boxing or kickboxing, but with very large men involved. Perhaps the most dramatic difference between the ancient sports and their modern equivalents, simply from the point of view now of athletic competition, was in the equestrian events. These were held in a hippodrome, which, of course, was much larger than the sanctuary itself, this horse track. And so it was built outside of the Sanctuary of Zeus, located southeast of the current sanctuary, by the banks of the river, so that sand could be used as the basic surface for the horse racing track. There were races for younger as well as fully grown horses. The word used in Greek for the younger horses is often translated as foals, but it probably should be taken to refer to yearlings or perhaps even two-year-olds. They raced over 4.5 miles. There were also chariot races, both for teams of 2 horses and teams of 4 horses, and there were also chariot races for teams of mules. The chariot races were longer than the horse races, lasting up to 9 miles, and they must have been a truly amazing spectacle. These would have been some of the most astonishing events to watch at the ancient Olympics, because you often had as many as 40 chariots vying wildly for position on the racetrack. If these were 4-horse teams, do the math, you would have had 160 horses and their chariots and drivers trying to get into position on the track. We have an eyewitness description of the staggered start that was employed in order to try and create some order out of this chaos. Here's the description. When you've passed beyond the stadium, which is where, of course, the running races would have been held, at the point where the umpires sit, there is a place set apart for the horse races. Here's the description then of the hippodrome. The starting line is in the shape of the prow of a ship, so you have to imagine it as a triangle coming to an apex. And its prow is turned towards the course. Each side of the starting line is more than 400 feet in length, and in the sides are built stalls. These stalls are assigned by lot to those who enter for the races. Before the chariots or horse races is stretched a rope as a barrier. An altar sits as near as possible to the center of the prow, and a bronze eagle stands on the altar with its wings stretched out to the fullest extent. The man appointed to start the race sets in motion the mechanism in the altar, and when the eagle has been made to jump upwards so as to become visible to the spectators, a bronze dolphin attached to the starting rope falls to the ground. The barriers drop in sequence. As the first team starts, they reach those at the second station and those barriers drop. The same thing happens to all the horses in turn until at the ram of the prow, in other words, at the apex of the pyramid, they're all abreast. After this, says Pausanias, it is left to the charioteers to display their skill and the horses their speed. Pausanias goes on to describe a spectacle in which many of the chariots crash and the charioteers are wounded. It was incredibly dangerous. And if you've ever seen the chariot race filmed for the movie Ben-Hur, and I believe a man was actually killed in the filming of that, you might have some idea of just how chaotic these events would be. The great irony, however, of the equestrian events is that for all the skill and the bravery shown by the horses and their jockeys or the chariot drivers, it was the owners who received all the glory. Horses and mules were luxury items in ancient Greece, and this was a rich man's event. Alcibiades, the brilliant and reckless Athenian leader at the end of the 5th century, was famous, or perhaps infamous would be a better word, for being the only man ever to send 7 chariot teams to the Olympic Games at once and winning, in one race, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd place. Only in the equestrian events did the owner, not the athlete, win the victor's wreath. Euripides celebrated Alcibiades' success, composing a hymn for him that said, "Victory is noble, to do more than any Greek has ever done before, to obtain in the great chariot race the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd place, with easy step advanced to fame, to bid the herald 3 times claim the olive for 1 victor's name." So Alcibiades won a great deal of renown for this extraordinary Olympic accomplishment, although he didn't actually do any of the racing himself. Still, while most people were as crazy about their athletic heroes in ancient times as we are today, There were still some, like Xenophon, who thought that the veneration went too far. And he actually has a passage in which he says, if one should win a victory thanks to the swiftness of his feet, or when competing in the pentathlon there, in the sanctuary of Zeus at Olympia, or if one should gain the prize in wrestling or painful boxing, or in that fearful contest people call Pancration, to his fellow citizens he would be thought more glorious to look on than ever, and he would gain from his city all sorts of rights. And yet, says Xenophon, a city would gain little joy if someone should win in competition at Olympia, for that victory would still not fill its storehouses. So there were voices in antiquity as today that thought that perhaps the veneration of the Olympic athlete had gone a little bit too far. In our next lecture, we'll see why it was that the Olympics retained their stranglehold on the imagination of the Greeks.
We hope you've enjoyed the first of two free lectures on the ancient Olympics. See the list of Professor McInerney's courses on our website, or explore more courses in history, science, math, fine arts, and more available on DVD, audio CD, and audio download. It is our pleasure at The Teaching Company to provide you with the joy of lifelong learning every day with great professors, great courses, and a lifetime guarantee of your satisfaction. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call us at 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you from all of us at The Teaching Company.